Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am a deer in headlights.
Otherwise known as Michael Footer. Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 88. Oh, dear God, it's E3. Sort of.
Oh, this is so much fun. So welcome to our very first live streamed episode of Virtual Economy. We have a show lined up for you today.
Oops.
Like, it's a really good thing that I do the show notes like on a rolling basis, because this is the Summer Games Mess. You have tuned into the Summer Games Mess. All right, kicking off this week, CD Projekt is starting to feel Cyberpunk 2077's failed launch.
A little bit.
Now, just a reminder, we didn't have a show last week because we were visiting our dear friends Kat and Ryan in Maryland. So this is like 2 weeks of news just smushed together.
We're just smushing them together. So the company reported its earnings for the first quarter of its fiscal year ending on March 31st, 2021.
Yeah. Interestingly, and this kind of popped up right before we left, actually, the company-wide revenue. So remember, CD Projekt has a number of different operations. They don't just have CD Projekt Red. They've got GOG, and they've got some licensing related to a variety of their products.
Yes.
And games. So the company-wide revenue only grew 2% to 197.6 million zloty. That's about 54.1 million US dollars. Now, revenue from sales of products, that's Cyberpunk, Witcher 3 and the expansions, Gwent, Thronebreaker, Witcher 2 and the original Witcher, were up only 6.3%, and this is the largest driver of CD Projekt revenue. So, in the first full quarter since Cyberpunk 2077 launched, revenue for all of their products only went up
6.3%. That is minuscule for a publisher like CD Projekt.
Yeah.
Their net cash flow from operating was way up, which is not super surprising, because I would imagine that, you know, their expenses were way down, considering that they, you know, released a game. So, net cash flow from operating was way up. It was up 470%, which is incredible. But their operating profits were down by 55.8% to 37 million zloty, which is $10.2 million US. Mike, what else is going on?
So net profit was down 64.7% to 32.5 million zloty, which is 8.9 million US. So things have fallen off a cliff here. Now, remember when Cyberpunk first came out in early December, we talked about all the problems flattening that long tail.
Yep.
So when we talk about products, we talk about how you have this spike when the game comes out. And in terms of revenue, it's you're finally able to recognize all of that deferred revenue.
Yep. From your pre-orders.
Yep. And that's wonderful. And then what happens is things start to tail off. Now, if you're a GTA 5, here's your axis. You know, you're kind of floating down here. Now, along the way, you do things to create these spikes, these ripples.
Yes.
And that's sales, right?
Yeah.
You've got sales, you've got special offers, you've got
bundles.
Content drops, bundles, all of that sort of thing. And depending on the game, kind of lift that up along the way. Now, that's not to say that Cyberpunk isn't going to get that lift. But given what the promise of the game was, you know, we kind of expected it to float above the axis around here. And now it's, shark cards, exactly. So now you've got the tail being depressed. So what ultimately happens is, even when they get those spikes, they're not going to be as high.
It's not going to be nearly as high, and it's not going to be for nearly as long either. They've lost a lot, not just customer and player trust. They've lost investor trust.
Yes. So along with that, they did not actually report sales figures for Cyberpunk 2077.
They did not. And CD Projekt has not met Sony's metrics for relisting on the PlayStation Store either.
In fact, they wouldn't even discuss the details of the conversations with Sony and Microsoft around the new gen versions. And we assume that both platform holders are going to be very, very closely scrutinizing what ends up happening with those games. They're not just going to rubber stamp certification. They're going to want to make sure those games work so well, because they don't want to get caught up in a massive chargeback wave again, like they did with the first game.
And it wasn't even massive, right?
Yeah,
it was in the grand scheme of things, and with regards to the revenue brought in and their bottom line, it was barely affected at all. So 300 people are still working on Cyberpunk. It's not as though Cyberpunk 2077, the video game, is dead. It is still being worked on. And
yeah,
they're still working on the current gen release. And I know that people are like, yeah, maybe it'll come out this year, maybe it won't come out this year. I think that the current gen is going to be the next big push. I don't think the patches were able to do enough to recapture, you know, trust, and I don't think that it's going to be enough to recapture, quite frankly, media interest, which, or influencer interest, and both of those are really important and divergent pieces of the marketing puzzle.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was a question here in chat, what happened to the free DLC? They're working on it. And in fact, I think those 300 people right now are working on not just the free DLC that was promised, but the paid DLC that is going to create some of those spikes along the way. So one of the things that one of the other things that popped out along the way was that CD Projekt's ransomware hackers, remember, that slowed down a lot of the patching because their workflow froze up due to ransomware. Seems that some of the information seems to have surfaced, including source code for Thronebreaker, The Witcher 3, the upcoming ray tracing enabled Witcher 3 re-release, which is also due out on the now current gen consoles. Source code for Cyberpunk, a variety of assets, SDKs for a number of platforms, which, oh boy, that's not good, because the NDAs around those SDKs, and including PS5's SDK, was apparently released. Big question that hasn't been discussed is how much personally identifying information was compromised this ransomware attack.
Yeah, and we definitely don't know.
Yeah.
It's a lot. There's a lot going on. And remember, there are also the ongoing lawsuits that have been brought forward by investors. And CD Projekt is under some serious pressure. And while I am never rooting for anyone to fail, because that's just not who I am, and quite frankly, that's not our vibe, I hope that they can figure this out. Genuinely. I hope they can figure it out ethically, and I hope that they can take care of their people, and I hope that they can take care of the players that have loved Cyberpunk and The Witcher and, you know, all of the various pieces that they have published and developed over the years.
Yeah, I think CD Projekt's going to learn the hardest lesson in any creative medium is you're only as good as your last project.
Yep, absolutely. Speaking of some oopsies, though.
Oopsies!
Capcom sure did an oopsie, maybe. So this was an interesting one that was brought forward by a designer by the name of Judy A. Juracek.
Juracek? Yeah, that's the way I pronounce it.
So Juracek has filed a complaint in Connecticut, and this has been generously shared by Polygon. We will make sure that everything's in the show notes as per usual.
Yep,
and this complaint alleges that Capcom used photos from her 1996 book Surfaces in a number of games, including Resident Evil 4, Devil May Cry, and more.
Yep, so the book collects 1,200 of Juracek's photos of different textures, so that she went out and she took photos, reference photos. The idea for the book Surfaces is that it's a visual research reference for artists and designers.
Yeah, and if anyone that's worked in design or anyone that's done any amount of art knows that textures and reference photos are such an important facet of the work that we do. If we don't have those, we're just pulling from our brains, and our brains are only kind of, you know, creative. We also sometimes need, like, how does glass actually break? I don't feel like breaking glass today. Let me go look up a photo. So that's what Juracek's book Surfaces was all about. So in this complaint, Juracek identifies more than 80 of her photos that are used across a number of Capcom games, including the Resident Evil 4 logo.
Now, it seems like she had some evidence already before the data breach. which was due to yet another ransomware attack, if you'll recall. But the breach helped complete the picture. It included high-res images and file names, and at least one of those file names was identical to a file on the CD-ROM that came with her Surfaces book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the complaint also includes a nod to the other accusation Capcom recently faced, and this is from Dutch filmmaker Richard Raphorst, that one of the Resident Evil Village monster designs is actually stolen, allegedly stolen, from his movie Frankenstein's Army. So again, we dropped the link in the show notes, which includes the full complaint.
Yep. So we reached out to friend of the show, IP lawyer Ethan Jacobs, to ask for his opinion on this. Ethan is a regular contributor to Virtual Economy. He is always generous with his time and his knowledge. So we asked about this suit and what he thought. So what he told us was that at face value, some of the use might be fair use. Now, if you look at the Resident Evil 4 logo, that's a good one, because what it did was it took some of the breaking glass and then put it into the 4 of the Resident Evil 4 logo.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, it lines up. That might be considered transformative. So they might get away with a fair use defense. Remember that fair use is an affirmative defense that effectively says, yeah, we use this, but it's okay for a number of reasons. Now, in the U.S., and which is where this case is filed, there is a 4-factor fair use test. And you don't have to meet all 4 of them. As long as you meet one of them, you could potentially get through with a fair use defense. So the first factor is the purpose and character of the use. Now, this usually refers to, are you using it for education? Are you using it for criticism or commentary or news reporting or research? So this one probably doesn't apply. However, this is where transformative use does come into play. So they're not just reprinting her photo. They, you know, for the Resident Evil 4 logo in this case, where it's like they took a piece of it and they kind of used it to help stylize the logo. That might be transformative.
Sure. And the second factor is the nature of the copyrighted work. So in this instance, because it is creative, because it's photography, it's probably not a good defense.
Yes. The third one is the amount or substantiality of the portion used. So did Capcom use enough of her work, an individual work, for it to be counted, or did they use only a small portion? Again, in the logo, that might not be a substantial use of it, but if they reproduce something more broadly, as it appears in some of the images they might have, that might be part of an issue.
Absolutely. The fourth factor is the effect of the use on the potential market for or the value of the work. And so the big question on this one is, does Capcom's use diminish the value or marketability of Juracek's work? And that one, that's exceptionally subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not qualified to speak to that at all.
Right. I would say that in this case, because they're not...
it's not in the same industry.
Right.
I guess, I guess if they had fully reproduced the work and sold it as a print, and
taken money out of her, her pocket,
exactly. And I think that would be more of an argument than, you know, they used it for reference and they maybe used it a little too heavily. So what else did Ethan have to say, Mike?
So he pointed out that Juracek doesn't actually own some of the copyrights she alleges to own. So for instance, she went and took a photo of a pattern of a door. So let's say I took a photo of wallpaper, which has distinctive patterns, or I took a picture of a font on a screen, right? So she would not own the pattern of the wallpaper or the texture on the door or
the font, because those are all attributable to their original makers.
Yes. She owns the photo.
The composition. She owns the composition of the photo.
Yes. So that's one of the issues. Quote from Ethan here, quote, in most of the examples, the complaint alleges exact copying of images that probably aren't defensible.
And that's tough, because like we are like, for me especially, because I know how challenging it is out there to be a creative and to be selling your work and to be out there selling your wares essentially. And then a big company comes up and they're just like, well, we have more money than you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's got to be really tough, because the other portion of this was Ethan's quote on whether or not Capcom might settle. So this is directly from Ethan. So, quote, "It's likely Juracek's lawyers gave Capcom a chance to settle before suing, but the parties couldn't necessarily reach terms. Most cases settle, and this one will, if the parties agree on a number. The gulf between the ceiling on available damages and what the parties probably would have agreed to pay to license the images in the first instance, creates some incentive to litigate, at least for a while." Mm-hmm. So in other words, Capcom might have infringed here, but the request for relief is so high that it's actually worth litigating.
Yeah. The interesting thing here is that because there are 80 images referenced, some of them may be fair use, some of them might be in the middle, but some of them might be really a problem for Capcom.
Yeah.
So again, there's a lot of strategy around settling mm-hmm. something like this. Mm-hmm. You may decide that it's not worth it to litigate because there's a meeting of the minds, like, okay, we can pay you X for each of these. Mm-hmm. Now, if she came in and said, "I want $1 million for each of these images," I don't remember if we had looked at the prayer for relief.
I didn't have a chance to look at the prayer for relief on this one.
Yeah, I can kind of scroll down real quickly if we want. But if she was asking for too much when they were at the table trying to settle, now remember, the prayer for relief might be significantly more.
Yeah.
Than what she was asking for, because now she has to go through the process of litigation.
And it's expensive. Litigation is very expensive. Litigation lawyers are very expensive.
So, yeah, she might actually be asking for more now. But if she was asking for a ridiculous sum at the bargaining table when they were trying to settle, Capcom might have been looking at this going, there is no way that our use of this warrants this licensing fee. So they'll litigate for a little while. Maybe try to work her down, and maybe this will eventually settle out.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of discovery, because someone asked me, is like, oh, well, is discovery going to be worse for Capcom because they could find out that there's more instances? Like, she can apparently investigate that anyway, even without litigation. Mm-hmm. So that isn't necessarily a motivating factor, because I followed up with Ethan on that as well. But it's really interesting. I'm very curious to see how this plays out, because now you've got Capcom, which has been very savvy in a lot of ways, on the receiving end of two accusations of lifting other people's work.
Yeah, this is going to be a weird one to watch out for. And, you know, big props to Polygon on bringing this forward. It was really nice to see. All right, Mike, what else do we got here? We have Before Investment Interlude. So mm-hmm. there is an interview with Herman Holst, head of PlayStation Studios, about upcoming games and business decisions. Now, this was an internal interview, so this was done on the PlayStation blog.
And I think it's important that we talk about this a little bit. Like, it is completely fine, and we have seen this shift towards having internal communications where companies can control the message. Bethesda does it. Oh, Microsoft does it.
Everybody does it.
Sony does it. A lot of publishers. Ubisoft does it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine, because it's very clear who is doing the interviewing and the kind of information you're going to get from it. You're going to get very heavily sanitized information. They're going to only tell you, because it isn't journalism.
No,
right?
This is content marketing. Like, yes. let's be really real here. This isn't even branded editorial. This is honestly in part content marketing.
Yep. And we're going to talk a little bit after Quick Hits about E3 and about some of the stuff that they've done that is along those lines that's not very ethical. So, but we'll get there. Hold on. So first up, Hulse says that there are more than 25 first-party games in development. He did mention the new God of War. He did not call it God of War Ragnarok. So there's this Mandela effect thing that's going on where the first teaser that came out said Ragnarok is coming, and there were some outlets that reported the game as God of War Ragnarok. Now, sure, that might end up being the name. It makes a lot of sense. It's perfectly fits, but mm-hmm. that is not a name that Sony has ever said. Now, that brings us back to the issue I think we talked about on the last show, mm-hmm. where in that business document, in that strategy document, they lifted the logo a fan logo off of the internet. Someone Googled it internally and put it into the strategy document, which was kind of a mess. So it's either someone didn't have the logo internally because the game wasn't actually announced as that and they just lifted one off the internet knowing that that was the name, mm-hmm. or the Mandela effect has come full circle and has infected Sony. So
who knows? Who knows? It could be one or the other. It could be both. Not sure. As for Horizon, what Hulse said is that they believe that they are on track to release this holiday season, but they're not quite certain yet. So from my perspective, and this is my speculation, I want to make that very, very clear. I believe that Horizon Forbidden West will come out Q4 fiscal 2022.
So you are pegging like a January, February, March launch, yes. 2022.
I'm thinking it's probably going to end up being a February launch, if anything. Rarely do we see AAA games that aren't Nintendo launching in January. So probably February or March.
And based on what we heard about Ratchet & Clank, where Insomniac did not crunch...
Oh, I'm so proud of them!
I would say that if Sony as a publisher, as an owner of these first-party studios, if Herman Hulst is saying, do not crunch, if that's coming from the top, then yeah, I think it's more likely that we'll see Horizon in Q4 because they're not going to do things that hurt their developers.
Good.
I don't know if that was an Insomniac decision, if that was a Ted Price decision, or if that was a Herman Hulst decision for all of PlayStation Studios.
It could very well be that it was a combination of the two, but we honestly don't know. Yeah, so God absolutely. Of War, on the other hand, the new God of War, is going to be expected next year, so in 2022. Yes. And, bonus, it will also be available on the PlayStation 4. So this is a significant, like as Mike put it in our show notes, a significant retreat on their whole generational divide approach. You know, there are still PlayStation 5-only games out there, but because the market saturation is probably a lot smaller than what they were originally anticipating, because no one could have anticipated COVID. No one could have anticipated the fallout of what happened when essentially the entire world shut down to try to contain this pandemic. You know, no one could have seen that coming, especially when it comes to, you know, hardware manufacturing. So there aren't enough PS5s out there. Obviously, absolutely. You see one in the background for us. You know, it's just behind me, but they're still very, very difficult to get. So being able to capitalize on it and have more of that intergenerational approach is very smart in terms of those business decisions, but it is it's a big departure from what they originally set out as.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Again, as you said, it's good though. Getting these games into more people's hands. I think the reaction that came out online, like, oh, PS4 is holding the game back. I'm like, it's early enough in the generation that no, it's
probably not.
It's probably not the case.
No.
So if they're able to do it, then great. That's fantastic. So what else did they say? This is very interesting, and I think you and I have talked about... you and I have talked about philosophical differences.
When could we have talked about philosophical differences? A literal year ago?
A literal year ago. So talking about PC, Horizon Zero Dawn on PC has been, quote, very successful. And
good.
It shows that there... But this is what Herman Hulst said. It shows there is an appetite from gamers, quote, outside the PlayStation ecosystem. That is so interesting to me because if you think about how Microsoft talks about PC, PC is part of the Xbox ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Even though Sony is starting to wake up to the fact that releasing on PC means you're going to reach new people, you're going to get double dips. Lord
oh, yeah.
knows you're going to get the double dip from a lot of people. They don't see PC
it, tag
as part
yourself,
of their...
I'm people.
I'm people too.
I am always people. I always double dip. Like it's just.
I gotta remember to buy Sunset Overdrive on PC.
I also have that game on PC. I definitely purchased it. So it is a very interesting way of looking at it. But I also think that it's important to remember that when we think about the differences between Microsoft and Sony, Sony doesn't have an operating system on a PC platform. Right? Like they just don't. It's just not a thing. And yep. Microsoft does, obviously, because Microsoft has Windows. So it's a little easier for them to make those calls and for them to say, well, Windows is part of the piece or is part of the Xbox ecosystem. Well, that's very easy for them to say because they own Windows.
Yeah, absolutely. But also don't expect a Game Pass like approach to first party or even PC releases day and date, even though they are doing well. It seems like Herman Holtz very specifically pointed out like 2 years later is just completely fine.
Mm-hmm.
And said this, quote, "I want to emphasize that PlayStation will remain the best place to play our PlayStation Studios titles at launch.
Mm-hmm.
But we do value PC gamers and will continue to look at the right times to launch each game. Ben Studio just released the PC version of Days Gone on May 18th, so that's about 2 years after the PS4 release."
It's a heck of a long tail.
It is.
Yes.
And I think that's fine. I mean, we've talked about, again, GTA 5 is such a perfect example for a number of these things.
It's so interesting.
If you think about how Rockstar released GTA 5, it was 360 and PS3, and then it was PC,
mm-hmm.
and then it was Xbox One and PS4, and now here we go, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As Mandy pointed out in the chat here, basically once the long tail settles and sales are less impactful, release to PC. It's anything to create those spikes, bring those players in. And remember, because we're moving to a model that isn't just about unit sales, that's just a piece of
it isn't
of
just about the money, it's about the engagement. Engagement exactly. is an incredibly important factor when taking a look at the success of the long tail of a game or even of a franchise in general. So Holst also tried to put to bed the rumors about Sony turning westward and deprioritizing Japan. So this is a direct quote from the internal interview. Quote, "I want to be very clear that Japanese games and Japanese talent remain extremely important to PlayStation Studios and to Sony Interactive Entertainment. Japan and Asia are strongly associated with our legacy."
Yes. So the other piece, Sony Ben has confirmed that it's working on a new IP. So goodbye for now. Days Gone. We will never forget the most romantic line in gaming. "You can have this ring back as long as you promise to ride me as much as you ride your bike." Just the most romantic.
Yeah.
It was. I watched that scene because I needed to remind myself that it was real.
Yep. Okay.
I wish I hadn't.
I really wish we hadn't said that right here, right now. I'm very upset at you.
But
what time is it?
It's time for Investment Interlude. So this is the segment where we talk about mergers, acquisitions, investments, big deals that are big deals.
That are big deals. So the first thing that we have on deck is research group Games One has released its updated Unicorn Index. Unicorns are private companies valued at more than $1 billion. So there's a lot going on here. I'm not going to go through everything, but I am going to pick out what I think are the most interesting ones here. So topping.
And these are in order of rank, by the way.
Thank you.
No problem. Like the Roman numerals correspond to their actual rank. I did a thing.
You did. I'm very proud of you. So Tom.
I'm just getting the summer pool ready. So many bells.
So many bells for Tom Nook to take a bath in and to go swim around in. So topping the list is TikTok owner ByteDance at $62.5 billion U.S. Second on the list there is Epic at $28.7 billion. There's also Krafton at $17.9 billion, Valve at $17.8 billion. We also have, oh my goodness, there's so much on here. Iron Source is at $9.4 billion, Smilegate at $8.9 billion, and then Discord. This one's interesting.
This one is real interesting.
Because they're sitting at $7 billion, which is actually
in ninth place, which is actually
lower than previous valuation estimates.
Remember when they were looking at a sale, people were thinking that if they were to be sold, it would have been $10 billion minimum.
Minimum. It was $10 billion plus.
Yep.
So it's very interesting to see that, to see Discord sitting at a $7 billion valuation, you know, from the Unicorn Index.
Also on the list is MiHoYo, which is Genshin Impact at $4.6 billion, and Niantic, of course,
yeah,
Pokemon Go, and a number
Niantic.
Of other games at $4 billion. The total value of the top 25 unicorns is $200.2 billion. That's wild. That is absolutely wild. There were some very interesting negative unicorns on this list, though.
This is cool and kind of heartbreaking at the same time.
So Magic Leap's valuation has fallen from $6.7 billion in April 2019 to $450 million. They are now under that billion mark in mid-2020. That's a 93% devaluation.
That's a bummer. And I know that Magic Leap was like, lots of developers were really like, lots of augmented reality developers and virtual reality developers were really excited about Magic Leap when it comes to when it comes to the tech, because Magic Leap was doing such cool things with their AR headset, but they were so expensive you couldn't even like necessarily get them.
Yep. The other one was Improbable. The $2 billion valuation from July 2018 has been marked down 75%. So they're at 500 million, I guess.
That is rough. All right. M&A advisors Drake Star Partners has issued a new report on game industry deals during the first 5 months of the year. The record-setting year so far includes, all right, buckle up. This is really interesting. 527 investments, acquisitions, and IPOs. Total of, to the tune of, $49 billion. Deals were worth $21 billion. Hey, Mike, what's a SPAC?
A special... Oh, crap.
Yeah, I can never remember what a SPAC is. It's, like, I know what it is conceptually.
Special purpose acquisition company. So the way it works is that it raises money and then it finds a good company to acquire, making that acquisition company a public company. Amanda, can you help out?
I got it. I got it.
Awesome.
I got it.
So SPACs raised $4.2 billion, and then another $4.2 billion was raised in minority financing from venture capitalists and strategic investors. $5.4 billion was raised across 23 IPOs. Just absolutely wild. And that's the first 5 months of the year.
That's wild.
Let's see, $14.2 billion was raised in secondary offerings and debut financings. So secondary offerings, you've already done your IPO, you're issuing new stock, debut financings, so that's angel seed, all that fun stuff.
Yep.
And then this is up from Invest Games Q1 estimate of $39 billion. So we went from $39 billion to $49 billion in the span of 2 months. So another $10 billion in 2 months in deals.
That's wild.
And just a quick reminder. 2020's total was $33 billion. So we are already $16 billion ahead of that in the first 5 months. How wild is that?
That is exceptionally wild. Also, I really messed up, folks. It is actually not join. It is question.
Oh, there we go.
My
awesome.
Bad. My bad.
It's all right. Hey, we're ironing out the kinks. This was an impromptu recording.
There we go. There you go. Yay! Now you're in. Okay, cool beans. Okay. All right, Mike. What do we got here? We got some mobile stuff going on.
We have a number of acquisitions.
We do. All right, so Take-Two, which did not see value in mobile, because as we've talked about, on the two opposite ends of the spectrum, we have Ubisoft on the cutting edge of technology and trends, and we have Take-Two on the other side where they are technological and trend laggards. Neither is bad, neither is wrong. It's just very different. Mm-hmm. So, Take-Two didn't really see the value in mobile and has acquired its third mobile developer. So, this is, its third mobile developer is Nordeus, I guess.
Yeah.
So Nordeus is known for its top 11 soccer series. The franchise has more than 240 million registered users. The deal is worth $378 million, $225 million in cash on hand, and $90 million in newly issued Take-Two shares. There's also earnout consideration based on performance over the first 2 years.
Yep. Another acquisition, Facebook has acquired Unit 2 Games, developers behind the sandbox/metaverse platform Crayta. Up until the acquisition, Unit 2 was cozy with Google Stadia, with Crayta appearing exclusively on the cloud platform. No terms were disclosed. This is yet another huge blow to Google.
Skillz, a mobile game competition platform, has announced plans to acquire esports advertising platform Aarki. That is Aarki.
Aarki.
A-A-R-K-I. The deal, which is worth $150 million in cash and stock, is expected to close Q3 2021.
Tiny Build has announced it has acqui-hired Dog Helm and developer Matt Dabrowski, who is the developer of Streets of Rogue. So acqui-hiring is when you care more about the people than the existing products, and you want to bring those people on and all of their IP and previous projects just happen to come with them. Tiny Build actually published Streets of Rogue, so the two have a relationship already. Matt Dabrowski is a solo dev. I think Dog Helm is just the company or the name he works under.
Awesome. So,
and that, yeah, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right. Consideration for this deal was $6.5 million. That's a good hire, right?
That's a very good hire.
Yeah. Split evenly between shares and cash. And that amount includes both upfront and deferred payments over 3 years.
Absolutely. You know what I love to see? You know what we love to see? We love to see predatory nonsense die. So the NFT market has dropped 90% since its peak in early May, according to a report on crypto site Protos. That's why it makes perfect sense that more game industry interests are getting involved, you know, just on the decline, just like always. Perfect sense. Brilliant. Smart. Love it. So much. So much.
So much.
So much. The latest in this is Chronicle, which has raised $3.2 million for its NFT-based collectible card platform from a number of blockchain venture capitalists. The platform is expected to be launched this summer with, quote, major brands, whatever.
Top men. With top men on it. Major brands.
Top men. Chronicle is also designed to ensure that original creators get paid. We love this. That's a thing I love. Mm-hmm. The details are kind of fuzzy, though, especially without knowing which brands are attached or how they will use it.
Major brands.
I don't do salutes.
All right. And our last one. Oh, no. We have two more for the day. My mistake.
We do.
A new Helsinki-based studio, Quicksave Interactive, has raised $1.3 million for HTML5 social games that can be played in a browser or via chat apps like Facebook Messenger.
That's a good one.
Yeah, those chat app games are kind of interesting.
They're fun.
Yeah. There was one, and especially when they're integrated with marketing campaigns, there was a cool Halo one at one point.
There was. It's actually kind of cute to play some of those Facebook Messenger games with the kids.
The seed funding round was led by Convoy Ventures with participation from Sisu Game Ventures, Raptor Group, and Lago Innovation.
Indeed. Istanbul-based Veloxia, known for its mobile idle game Space Colony Idle, has raised $3 million to grow its platform and expand beyond idle games. Collective Spark led the round, while Bogazici Ventures, Akportfoy, Gerasim,
this is mean. The most difficult one. Because this is all, I think they're all based in Turkey.
Oh, I always mess up everybody's names. I'm so sorry in advance. Sermayesi and other angel investors participated. Seriously, if I messed up your name, please know I am so sorry. I try my very best, but I am so bad at this.
Aha! And that was Investment Interlude.
And now it's time for a break.
Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we're back!
And we're back.
Mike, what time is it?
It's time for Quick Hits!
Complete with live jazz hands. All right, so leading us off, Mike, what's our first story?
Good guy Respawn, the Apex Legends developer and publisher EA, are paying community creators for their fan art. 6 community-created loading screens are going to be available as Twitch drops. Link your account, watch one of the selected streamers for an hour, and you get your loading screens. The reason why I wanted to throw this in here is because we've seen bad implementation of using the community.
Yeah.
Like that, what's the name of that? Hit Record with Ubisoft stuff, where it was a work on spec and paying out pennies. No, this was actually, hey, we're paying our creators, and that's awesome.
I have a lot of feelings and thoughts about that are not appropriate for this podcast. If you would like to know more, you can hit me up on Twitter. All right, Nintendo has won a $2.1 million has won $2.1 million, in a lawsuit against pirater ROM Universe. The suit was filed in September 2019 with a request of $15 million in damages. The judge set the award lower, obviously. And the ROM Universe website didn't just host the pirated games. Here's the clincher. They charged membership that allowed people to download faster, which is how the courts calculated the judgment.
Yeah. Dark Horse Comics has launched a new gaming and digital operation. The company will both license its properties and work with external developers directly. Going to be cool. Maybe we'll get some new Hellboy games.
That could be pretty cool. I'd be into that. EA has tweaked Knockout City's business model once more. Now that the Block Party trial is over, you can still play for free up to level 25. It's still free for Xbox, for Game Pass Ultimate and EA Play members. It's a bit of a confusing rollout, but now that the Block Party trial is over, things are getting a little bit more... It's got a little more clarity around it. It is a super cool game, though. Yeah. It is super cool. It's a huge hit in this house. Mm-hmm. Huge hit. We play it with the kids. I play it with the kids. Because, let me tell you, there's nothing more fun than playing video games with an 8 and 9-year-old and have watch them beat the crap out of other players with dodgeballs.
The game has also reached 5 million players, which really smart. Yeah, if you're going to buy it during the Epic sale because it knocks off £8, $10, yeah. Which is fantastic.
Absolutely.
Tencent is shutting down the China-only Call of Duty service, Call of Duty Online, rather. The service is ending on August 31st due to declining revenue and a lack of renewal from Activision. Players are being encouraged to shift over to Call of Duty Mobile, which makes sense. Call of Duty Online launched in 2015. I actually saw it at E3. I think it was in 2014 before they announced, maybe it was 2015, before they rolled it out because they were explaining how they had to tailor Call of Duty.
I think it was 2015 because I think you and I had a conversation about it after E3.
Awesome. Well, there you go.
Also from Tencent. Are we doing this?
Go for it.
Okay, because you highlighted it, and I was like, what's happening?
Yeah, sorry.
Also from Tencent, the company has opened a new office in LA with a target headcount of 150. This is Tencent's fifth U.S. location.
Yeah. Larian, the studio behind Divinity Original Sin and Baldur's Gate 3, has opened its seventh location. This one is in Barcelona. The big thing here is that the team at the fantastic port studio Blitworks has joined Larian and forms the core of this new team.
Nice.
Huge move for Larian. Blitworks
so
is fantastic.
Good.
They are one of the best port studios in the business.
They really are. They're phenomenal. Another new studio announcement, Activision seems to have established a new mobile studio, Activision Mobile, to develop AAA Call of Duty mobile game, I suppose.
Yeah, a new one. Yeah.
A new one, brand new one. Don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Also, there was a report right before we went live that apparently Call of Duty is skipping this week, but I didn't think we were supposed to see anything from Activision anyway.
It wasn't on our list.
Yep. Another new studio, Snowdin Studios, has announced the opening of Scarab Games. So Snowdin is owned by the massive Keyword Studios that owns like something like 60 plus studios.
It's a lot.
Scarab Games' purpose is to, quote, help major brands enter the lucrative world of AAA gaming. Essentially, the studio is all about working with Fortune 500 marketing execs to turn their IP into games.
Right.
The press release is extremely clinical. Quote, Scarab Games has created a proprietary roadmap to help brands from every sector distill their history and brand value into deep story-driven narratives and gameplay styles for original entertainment projects to help CEOs and CMOs navigate the landscape. If you want, you know, we talk about games as a spectrum, right? You've got art on one side, you've got pure business on the other, and a lot of games kind of fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, being commercial art.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this is we want to cash in on our IP, rather.
Yeah, this is definitely we want to cash in on our IP. And you know what? If they can, fine, great, do what you're going to do. But if the press release is as cold and clinical as it read, I can't imagine that the games will be much different. All right, so we have one more studio here. So Microids, the studio behind Siberia, Beyond a Steel Sky, and the recently panned XIII 13. I never know.
Yeah, that one's 13.
I never know with some of these games. That one's 13, but Roman numerals, has opened a new studio in Lyon called Microids Studio Lyon. The studio will be led by David Chomar, formerly of Ubient, BigPoint, Atari, and Sega. The company says it has 25 in-development games, both internally and in partnership with other studios.
Let's see. Riot's hero tactical shooter Valorant has hit 14 million monthly active users. Now,
very nice.
On its one-year anniversary, Riot
good
has announced that Valorant is coming to mobile.
Hey.
So like PUBG Mobile, Call of Duty Mobile, and the upcoming Battlefield and Apex Mobile games, Valorant will not be cross-play. It will be a self-contained mobile experience. No dates for beta tests or the release have been announced.
All right. Now, the next thing to talk about, I don't even know if we're going to be able to get to the rest of our show at this point.
We'll be able to finish quick hits, I think.
Okay, so let's talk about the itch.io indie bundle for Palestine Aid. So remember last summer when a bunch of excellent developers teamed up to create this amazing bundle for social justice on itch.io? Yeah, it's happening again. You can purchase the indie bundle for Palestinian Aid on itch right now. There are more than 1,000 games, and they are still accepting new games until the end of the day today. I think it's Elena over on Twitter, who's an indie developer, just like made this happen essentially, and it was incredible to watch because, you know, she's just such a lovely human being. So I purchased it. I purchased it for I think I threw in like $35 for it. It's only nice. It's a minimum donation of $5. Like, this is such a worthy cause, and there are so many great games in there. You definitely don't want to miss out on these games on itch, and you definitely don't want to miss out on taking care of people that need it.
Yep, and when we actually publish this podcast, the link to this one is in the show notes. We don't often put Quick Hits links in because they're just real quick, but this one will be in there.
Yes.
Ubisoft is reshaping its CEO bonus structure. Axios is reporting, based on recent Ubisoft government filings, that CEO Yves Guillemot was due to have part of his bonus based on increasing the publisher's gender diversity, and that's been replaced by targets based on reducing the company's carbon footprint. So the way this works is he has a 3-year bonus tied to gender diversity, improving gender diversity at the company. That hasn't been renewed, so it will still be going through over the 3-year period, but after that 3-year period is over, he will not have any bonus tied to that. Now, the reason that gender diversity is the one that's highlighted is because it's the one that's most easily tracked, but it is code for diversity in general at the company. Remember that if you're talking about bonus metrics, it has to be something that can be very, very easily tracked, so that it's a toggle switch. You either hit your goal or you didn't. But we know that, as we talked about on previous episodes, that Ubisoft is trying to repair its image after everything that happened last summer when the environment and culture of toxicity and harassment was exposed.
Absolutely. All right, speaking of executive compensation, CTW Investment Group has reiterated its criticism of Activision CEO Bobby Kotick's compensation package. Despite Kotick's 50% reduction in salary, CTW is urging shareholders to vote against the proposed compensation package for Kotick as part of the latest say-on-pay measure. So this is a direct quote. Quote, the compensation committee did not address longstanding shareholder concerns about executive pay practices at Activision by extending CEO Kotick's contract by less than 2 years. Given the repeated opposition to CEO Kotick's pay over the years, shareholders should expect to see a long-term reform of his compensation over a greater period than merely 1 year. The CEO's 2021 equity award will accelerate at maximum payout level, leaving most of the compensation reductions to apply to only one full year, 2022, and as such may only cover the equity award for next year.
That's a good eye. Like, CTW has really been doing excellent work in surfacing the issues with CEO compensation.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful because it helps us understand a little bit more about the different issues at
CTW
play.
Has been instrumental in our ongoing coverage of say on pay and executive compensation over the last year.
Yeah. So with that, and those were quick hits.
Okay, so those were quick hits.
Yeah, those were quick hits.
Jazz hands. Let's talk about the summer game mess.
Oh boy. So, well, that first little dip here, that Battlefield trailer, was an interesting trailer. It was a good tonal trailer.
Yeah, it was cool. And
I'm more interested in the gameplay stuff that's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about E3.
I love that has quotation fingers around it. E3. most importantly, let us talk about the information security issues.
Yeah.
That actively and honestly did prevent and will continue to prevent the two of us and, quite frankly, many other media professionals and even some analysts from giving their information to the ESA in the future. So normally, when you go out into the world and you're like, I'm going to put my information on a website, you usually put your information on a website that has security. It has, it utilizes SSL, so secure socket layer. There was no HTTPS, therefore there was no secure socket layer, and there was no SSL certificate being used for registration and for capturing user and registrant information. So, yikes, right out of the gate.
Yep. But then there is a feature, like the features that the E3 app has are absolutely mind-boggling. And we're going to talk a little bit about this in a second. But there is a way that you're encouraged to share information so that you know, it's in the system. The problem is there's no warning that it is easily searchable by literally anybody who also has signed who has signed up for the same thing. So if I put my information in, literally anybody could search it and have anything that I put in there.
It's awful. And I tweeted about this and I said, listen, there was a good workaround for this. And the workaround here was letting users know, hey, when you put this information in, you know, it's going to be accessible by pretty much anybody that searches your name. So this is not private. This is public. If you mean to put this in, great. If not, here's an option to keep this information private. Mm-hmm. Or here is an option to just remove this section of the registration for you specifically so that you don't accidentally put in your information, because we are just trained when it comes to user interfaces to just put our stuff in because we're ordering stuff online, because we're signing up for things online. So we just assume that, you know, and this all comes back down to object-oriented programming, right? Keeping your private parts private. It's a different concept, but it's similar. It's similar in this regard. There is no reason for that information to be public. And it really comes down to dangerous user experience and dangerous user interface design.
Yeah, it really seems like they have learned absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. But those aren't the only missteps.
No.
Along the way.
No.
So their social media presence is flippant. It's unprofessional.
It's edgelord.
It's edgelord stuff. And it's just not good. They're trying to be the good social media people, like Stein over at Xbox. And they're not. They're failing. It's really not good.
No. And quite frankly, Xbox is an irreverent brand, and that's kind of the point, is that it is consumer-facing for consumers. It's for gamers, by gamers, essentially, and that's not what E3 has been. E3, up until relatively recently, has been a trade show, and that's the purpose that it served for a long, long, long time, and that's why it was such an interesting way for, like, folks like us, when we were sitting on the outside, to look at the coverage and be like, this is so cool. I want to go there one day. I can't wait. Look at all these really cool things that, you know, I would have to be like, I know I made it if I got to go to E3 one day. And it's no longer like that, because it's a hollow shell of what it used to be.
Yeah. The other thing that kind of jumped out at me, and we saw this over the weekend, they tweeted out from the official account there was this interview with someone by the name of Mark Saltzman. Now, that rang a bell for me, because when we broke the news about the E3 2020 pitch deck before everything that happened, there was a list of paid promotions in there. And one of the paid promotions was with Mark Saltzman,
I can speak a little bit more about who Mark Saltzman is.
Yeah, go for it.
Seems like you're looking stuff up anyway.
I'm going to hold the link up so that
So for those of us that are hanging out either with us while we're recording it live or are listening to it later, for those that are not familiar, Mark Saltzman is a tech personality and host in Canada. And more often than not, you see Mark Saltzman's you know, advertisements and you see his gadget recommendations. That's what I've always loved Mark for, because his gadget recommendations were like, oh, that's a really, really cool thing to put on like my Christmas wish list, right? So you'll see him in like Cineplex Odeon, which is a Canadian chain of movie theaters more often than not. So like when I saw that, I was like, oh, I like Mark. Mark seems like a pretty cool guy. And, you know, I like his gadget recommendations. All right. What else are you up to over there, Mike?
Oh, I'm just responding. So yeah, here's the thing though. So this is part of what bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
You just said, well, I know him for his gadget recommendations.
Yeah, that's what I know him for. I know him for gadget recommendations. I know him for tech recommendations. Like this is, and specifically as part of pre-show footage, essentially, before mm-hmm. we see movie trailers.
So here's where my issue is. You've used his gadget recommendation.
Oh,
you
for
know
sure.
Him. Right. Do we know if he was paid for those or not? Because here's my issue.
Well, I'm fairly certain that Cineplex Odeon paid him. I don't know if the companies themselves, like if the individual gadget companies paid him specifically. I know Cineplex did.
Sure, but I'm wondering here because here's the thing. Based on everything we know about E3, and they did not respond to me. When I tweeted about this, they tweeted out this interview out as if it was a work of journalism. Like he interviewed people from E3. Nobody disclosed it as an ad. It's not disclosed as an ad on his podcast that the content was paid for. The ESA didn't disclose it. E3 didn't disclose it.
And
so I'm sitting here going, this isn't cool. Like if you are doing if something appears on the PlayStation blog, like we talked about earlier, right? As content marketing, as external comms.
And it's branded editorial at its, right. at the best, at best, it's branded editorial.
Yeah. This though, if ESA paid Mark Saltzman to put people related to E3 on his podcast, they and he should disclose that.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothers me that we know that this was part of their plan based on the link that I dropped into chat that's in our show notes from the work that the news that we broke on Game Daily last year. I guess it was last year, 2019.
It was 2019.
2019. What
it was not last year. It was, I believe,
September 2019.
Yeah, I believe it was September 2019. It was before I left. So the thing to also remember is that while Americans and American creators and podcasters and personalities and everything like that are held to a very specific standard with the SEC and the FTC, it is not the same thing in Canada. I don't think that the laws are quite reflective. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, it's different. So I don't know if Mark would actually have to disclose that from a legal perspective.
From an ethical perspective,
but
I think
an ethical
important.
Perspective, I would tend to agree from an ethical perspective for sure. But I think it is important to make that distinction between the two countries and the two sets of laws.
Mm-hmm. Additionally, we just watched the Battlefield trailer. Quick correction. So Battlefield is going to be a $70 game on PC and current gen.
Oh.
So they are moving into the $70 price point.
Okay. Wow. That's interesting.
So the ESA ripped off a Battlefield, some Battlefield key art from 3 or 4. And it is they ripped it off from a bootleg desktop wallpaper site. And they're using it as their 404 error screen, complete with the watermark from the bootleg desktop wallpaper site.
Yeah.
Like, whomever they hired. So more evidence that whomever they hired does not understand, like, is bad at their job. Like, that's a no-brainer. You don't use copyrighted images when you are building out somebody's website. So whether that was provided by the ESA
mm-hmm.
or it was provided by the developer of this app and website,
mm-hmm.
somebody along the way should have known and said, we can't use that. Also, EA doesn't like us very much, so they're not involved with E3. So that's another thing that happened. It's just a comedy of errors all the way down.
In addition to that, there were a lot of problems with the app experience, just in terms of getting everything set up, getting logged in, getting signed up for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. And don't even get me started on the media and industry vetting process. Those were both nightmarish from what I understand. But the thing that really did stand out for me as a reflection of how out of touch the ESA actually is that there are default pronouns to he, him, and they are, in fact, unchangeable.
Yes. It's absolutely tone deaf in the current environment.
Now, I can always give grace when things don't go the way that they plan. And I'm sure that the default unchangeable he, him pronouns was not done on purpose. I don't believe that was done as a, oh, well, this is a thing that we intended to be like this. Obviously, this isn't a bug. And this is, you know, a technological issue. But it doesn't excuse it.
Yeah, there's no way to change them in the app, though. So it's not...
It's not good.
It's thoughtlessness.
Yes.
So, you know, the other, obviously someone brought up, I think it was Greg brought up the Pit Crew ripoff avatar thing where it looks like you have a bunch of dead-eyed people
ugly.
Who have been running around on sliders and five-hour energy for a week. You had people who didn't get their media approvals until this week when the media side of things starts. Mm-hmm. It's just...
It's rough.
It's just bad all the way across the board.
Yeah.
And it feels like, look, if they had done, they had 15 months, right? 15 months of both good and bad examples. Good examples of things that they wanted to use as ideas for how to make E3 digital, E3 online great. They had bad examples for things not to do. PAX Online was a good example. And it feels like their booths, like some of the booths are just like not populated. They're like, oh, by the way, come back throughout the week. You have to check in with a booth to see if more stuff has been added. Also, we couldn't organize a schedule until 2 days before, so people could, you know, for people to know when things are going on. Also, the schedule's in flux. Also,
which is why our schedule is completely bonkers. So essentially, what we like this week when we are streaming and simulcasting, essentially alongside a lot of what is going on this week. I mean, just like be patient with us because we don't even know what's going on yet.
So there have been a lot of things where if EA or the ESA had done literally nothing and just tried to create the schedule and help communicate, that would have been enough.
Yeah.
Like they knew, baby. That would have been enough.
Yeah.
If they had just gotten out of the way. The problem is they're trying to brand everything as E3. They're trying to be relevant in a place where, quite frankly, they're not necessary. That's
they're not necessary.
Right.
And it's something that has been a conversation now for a couple of years is how necessary is E3. And we learned last year that E3 is in fact not particularly necessary. And that publishers can do just fine on their own. It is, I mean, yeah, in a way it is E3 versus the Summer Game Show, but I think there's even more to it where it comes down to what do we trust? What do we care about? What are our values? How are we aligned with each of these pieces of the mess that is, you know, convention season now, digital convention season? So let's talk some trends.
So we talked about this for those of you who were here prior to us, the surprise of the hour-long countdown for Battlefield. You might have heard some of this before. If you're joining us, this will seem new. But as you know, Manda and I do a lot of trends work.
We do
every year. We write about the trends that we've seen, the trends that we're expecting, and there are a couple of things that we're looking at. Obviously, there are trends that are going to emerge, and we'll talk about those along the way. But here are three things that kind of we think are going to define not just the next week, but this summer in particular.
Mm-hmm. So the first thing that we want to talk about are the no-shows, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So the big no-shows here. Wait, are we talking about the three R's immediately, Mike? I'm sorry, I lost the thread
for
a sec.
So no, the COVID no-shows first.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was just like, I lost the thread. Oh God, what happened? don't mind me. I'm not fully alive yet. I've been up since 6 and I don't normally get up at 6. Okay, so anyway, the COVID no-shows are the first big trend to explore. So we are not seeing Prince of Persia, which is not surprising, considering that we know that it went immediately back into development after we saw a piece of it last year. Hogwarts Legacy will not be shown off, which is both no great surprise and no great loss. Mm-hmm. And my heart goes out to the developers that are working on Hogwarts Legacy, knowing that as much as I have loved Harry Potter over the years, that I cannot play your game. Gotham Knights will also is a notable absence.
Remember, that was supposed to be out this year.
It was supposed to be out this year. And Suicide Squad is another notable absence for E3 this year.
Yeah, so that's three big games from WB we're not going to see. Obviously, they have a Back for Blood. Remember, they're working with Turtle Rock on that. So that's that is going to be here. But those aren't the only games. There have been a number of titles that we kind of expected to see that we thought would be further along, where for one reason or another, we're not going to see. We're not going to see any other EA games. I think, as someone noted, Andy McNamara, who was my boss over at Game Informer and is now over at EA, tweeted out that I think the Battlefield gameplay is going to be part of the Xbox show on the 13th. So that's really exciting. We're seeing no campaign for Battlefield 2042. So we did ask that. No Saints Row, no Metro, no Time Splitters. Obviously, that studio is just being formed right now.
Yeah, that would be an unreasonable ask.
Yeah, there was one more. And no Dead Island. Dead Island 2 being a giant unknown, of course. So there are
Dead,
a lot of
Dead
games
Island
that,
2?
That, yeah, you don't remember Dead Island 2?
No, I don't remember Dead
you
Island
remember
2.
Remember the trailer with the guy jogging?
Yeah.
And then he turns around, like he's running from zombies, and then he turns into one at the end. I actually played Dead Island 2, believe it or not. And I'm not talking about Riptide, I'm talking about Dead Island 2. It was Gamescom 2015, I believe. They had a pre-alpha demo.
I think I'd just be happy with Dying Light 2.
Yes.
Because that game looks really cool.
Yeah, so we're not going to see any of that stuff. I don't know what's going to be at the Coke Primetime. I remember Coke Media owns Deep
Silver.
We will
see what's going to happen at Coke Primetime. We will be live stream with simulcasting it, yes, alongside, so definitely tune in for that. What else do we want to talk about? Oh, let's talk about the three R's, Mike.
Let's talk about the three R's again.
All right, so Mike, take us through what the three R's actually are.
Okay, setting the stage here, Capcom is excellent at this, and in fact, while they're not the only publisher to have done this, they really have they were one of the first to actively embrace the strategy of using existing games and their existing IP to really fill out their catalog.
Yeah,
so Resident Evil 2 remake, Resident Evil 3 remake being very good examples of that. So the three R's are reboot, remake/remaster, and re-release. So let's start at the top. Reboot. If we think about reboots, Tomb Raider is the best example,
yes,
of a reboot. In 2013's Tomb Raider, obviously it reset the story, it reset the gameplay, it introduced a new way for us to see Lara, a three game story arc that was really interesting. So that is. I am credited as a source on the Wikipedia page for Dead Island 2. Go me. So that is what we mean.
What a twist.
Yeah. That is what we mean by reboot.
Yes.
So, Amanda, why don't you talk about remakes and remasters?
So the most recent examples of remasters and remakes that have really captured the collective consciousness would be Resident Evil. Resident Evil 2, Resident Evil 3, and I see some love for Resident Evil 4 for a potential, like, winky-winky remake this game.
Gosh, yes.
Right? And these are examples of very successful remake remasters that really did reignite. See what I did there? Reignite the fire for Resident Evil's older titles, especially if you had missed them, if you were too young when they came out and you weren't able to play them, if, you know, for whatever reason, you just didn't end up getting around to playing these games, breathing new life into previous games in a beloved franchise like Resident Evil makes the franchise more accessible to younger players, to new players, to players that might have just not, you know, gotten on that bandwagon right at the very beginning and had felt like, where do I start? I can't go back and replay all these old games because I'm not, you know, a video game preservation is not something that I've prioritized, right? I'm not saying that that's the case in this house, but for people that don't prioritize video game preservation, like say our very good friend in chat here, otherwise known as Digital Lozenge, and all of the wonderful stuff that Ryan is doing on a regular basis. I play RE for Kids.
RE for Kids would be great. There's actually a game called The Last Kids on Earth,
yes,
which is a kid-friendly zombie game.
Yeah, and we will...
It's based on a kid-friendly zombie book series.
Which also has a kid-friendly Netflix series. Yes. So, either, like, that aside, yeah, cool. Like, kids plus zombies, that could be something potentially very interesting. Another one of those remakes and remasters would be the Mass Effect Legendary Edition. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, people have been asking for that for years. Like, we don't necessarily need more Mass Effect games right this second, but we want to be able to go back and revisit those beloved stories that have meant so much to so many of us and introduce our friends that might have missed it the first time around because either it was just not something they cared about or they weren't, you know, they weren't interested at the time, and now they care, or they were too young at the time, you know, all of those beautiful things.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So Mass Effect Legendary kind of teeters in between the second R and the third R just a little bit.
Mass Effect
1 is more of a remaster. Mass Effect 2 and 3 is more of a re-release, which is the last R. So when we think about re-releases, these are games that are effectively relatively unchanged from their original releases. They're just coming out to new platforms. Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance is a great example of this. Not much has been done to this. It's just playable on a new platform. And re-releases are fine also.
Oh, for sure. It's also really great for back catalog dollars. And
yeah,
as we've talked about it, so much, especially with regards to like Ubisoft, with EA, with even with Take-Two, these are super important pieces of the puzzle for revenue.
Absolutely.
You know, because this is stuff that's already been out for a while. They can put it on sale. They can get those, you know, like we talk about, those nice little spikes, those nice little waves on the long tail of that, you know, of that decay curve. So it's, everybody loves back catalog games, man.
Yep.
They're good for the bottom line. They really are.
Yep. And the last big trend that works, there's two more. I'm gonna start with multi-pronged use of intellectual property. Now, we've talked about this a little bit on the show, but Amanda, why don't you walk through what we mean by this?
So the multi-pronged use of IP is kind of skirting on the edge, if not fully being entrenched in transmedia. So transmedia is taking IP and not just releasing it on a number of different platforms. So it's like, okay, well, this game specifically is on a bunch of different platforms. This is specifically talking about reutilizing the IP for different experiences. So having a mobile experience that's still tied to the core gameplay. So we're talking about Call of Duty Mobile, and we're talking about, you know, like upcoming Apex mobile game and the upcoming Battlefield mobile game and all that stuff. So all of that is really, really important for reutilizing IP in different ways. And then there is the additional portion of this, which is moving into things like television, moving into movies and comic books and books and addition, like in-person experiences, virtual reality experiences, augmented reality experiences, all of these things are so important when we talk about this multi-pronged use of IP.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ubisoft recently made news because I think there was a misinterpretation of something they said on their last earnings call where they were letting themselves off the hook on 3 to 4 AAA premium releases a year. And people are like, oh, they're moving into free-to-play. No, that's not what's happening. I think what that means is, and they did clarify this, is that they are going to be more flexible. They're not going to hold themselves to a standard that no longer applies to the current market.
Exactly.
So what it means is we could see, as we've seen with Battlefield, right? We have a new premium Battlefield game coming.
Mm-hmm.
Battlefield Mobile is finally coming. We know that that's going to be a separate experience, just like Call of Duty Mobile. And it wouldn't surprise me if, as part of the Battlefield rollout this year, we're going to see some kind of free-to-play option, like you've got Call of Duty. Call of Duty is such a good example of this because you've got your premium annual release, you've got Warzone, which is free-to-play, and then you've got Call of Duty Mobile.
And all of these exist in their own silos, mm-hmm. then they tend to feed into one another. So mobile can potentially feed into Warzone. Warzone can potentially feed into the premium experience. The premium experience feeds back into Warzone, which could potentially feed back into the mobile experience. But they are all separate. They're all different from each other in one
Absolutely.
Way, shape, or form.
So those are some big things. The last thing I want to talk about is because of all of the, going back to those COVID no-shows, right, and the delays that we've seen due to COVID, I expect that we are going to see a larger proportion of announcements related to big content drops, new announcements related to existing successful games. So I don't know if we'll see Fortnite stuff this week, but we could see, we know we're going to see Rainbow Six Extraction, but perhaps we could see some more Rainbow Six Siege stuff at the end of something, because there's an established audience. There's 5 years of history there. For Honor is another good one. Again, I'm kind of leaning on Ubisoft. I know we're not going to see new Division stuff. Remember, Division 2 content was supposed to be over, and they kind of extended it, but we're not going to see the new Division free-to-play game this week either. So we could see, I think we've got all the DLC for Immortals Fenyx Rising at this point, but we could see something new for Watchdog Legion. They really do need to reinvigorate that, because that game didn't do so well. Assassin's Creed DLC is another one, although I can't remember if all the DLC is out for that as well. But that's the kind of thing we're going to see. We're going to see a lot of attention focused on especially service games, live games. So Fall Guys could show up. Or Rocket League. Again, these are all Epic games, so who knows if what kind of role Epic's going to be playing. But think about those big service games and the people who are. We've got one DLC for Assassin's Creed, so yeah, we could see some focus on that at the Ubisoft.
That would be the smart thing to do, quite frankly. I mean, Assassin's Creed, the latest Assassin's Creed, was well received both critically and commercially. So I really enjoyed Valhalla like a lot. It's a cool game.
So that is the big pre-show trends that we're looking at. Now obviously more stuff is going to emerge through the week, and we will of course talk about that.
Oh, for sure.
A big part of our live streams of these events isn't just going to be about talking about the games. Of course, we're very excited about that, but it's also going to be identifying those little.
I am a hype monster, so you cannot stop the hype train. I will still be a hype monster on this channel and on this podcast. This is a thing that I will continue to be, and I can separate the hype from the business cases. So that is what we are going to focus on this week through, I believe Wednesday. So it's like a full week. You all get a full week of us doing nothing but streams. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing. So in terms of our schedule, though, our schedule is bonkers.
We're going to update the document and get that back out. But the most important thing is you will find us at 2 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. That is when Jeff Keighley's kickoff event is happening. We'll be right there. And then I think is Friday is we have Coke Prime Time at 3 p.m. Eastern. We will not be live streaming the IGN Expo. That's kind of tough because they have a lot of talking going on, and we want you to be able to hear that. So it's not a really good one.
No, we want you to be able to listen to the hosts over at IGN. They're good people doing good work. So, if you want to go and get their commentary, definitely go get their commentary. Mm-hmm. But we will be back literally all day on Saturday, starting at, I believe, 11 a.m.
Eastern is the Guerrilla Collective. Then we have the Wholesome Direct immediately following that at 1 p.m. Eastern. Ubisoft Forward at 3 p.m. Eastern. Then we have some conflicting stuff. We got to figure this out. Glitches, Future of Play is at 4:15 p.m. Eastern. Devolver Digital is at 4:30 p.m. Eastern. And then Gearbox is at 5 p.m. Eastern on Saturday. On Sunday, we kick off with the Xbox and Bethesda Showcase at 1 p.m. Eastern, flowing right into the PC Gaming Show at 2 p.m. Square Enix at 3:15 p.m. Eastern. I think we have a little break before we're back for Back for Blood, the PvP showcase at 5 p.m. And then the PC Gaming Show is at 5:30 p.m. Then the Future Game Show at 7 p.m. On Monday the 14th, we don't have a ton going on. Limited Run, our good friends at Limited Run are at 1 p.m. Eastern, and then Capcom is at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. Very excited about that. Monster Hunter Rise, Monster Hunter Stories 2.
Yay, Monsties!
There's some RE Village stuff in there, so that should be
probably some DLC that they're going to be announcing. So on the 15th is going to be a wild day. There's a lot scheduled for the 15th that we don't actually have times for yet, so we will be here likely all day.
Yep.
Again.
Kicking off with Nintendo at noon Eastern.
Yep. Kicking off with Nintendo at noon Eastern. We know that Bandai Namco is going to be at 5:25 Eastern. So we're gonna see what goes on with that. Now, in between all of this, we are obviously going to be, you know, on our own personal channels and everything like that, potentially. That's kind of in flux right now as well. So just be patient with us. It's going to be a weird week, but it's going to be lots of fun. Like, we're very excited. And with that.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the very first and tuning in for the very first live streamed virtual economy podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I am at Amanda Farrow, and I continue to refuse to spell my name. You can also subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconcast.com. Sometimes we write. Right now, we are not writing. And you can listen to us on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, and there's always one more that I forget.
Pocket Sand!
Ah!
I turn this way because of the way the camera is.
It's this way. It's this way. It was technically this way. Oh, who cares? It's fine. Whatever, it's all good. Anyway, so you can, we would love it. We would love it if you subscribed to the podcast. You followed us on Twitch, and that is twitch.tv/virtualeconomy. And if possible, we would love it if you would review the show. We love hearing the things that you have to say about us and say about our work together. And if you have any questions, Mike, where can people hit us up for questions, comments, reviews that are outside of the podcasting
platforms?
You can
DM us at Virtual Econcast. You can shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. If you tune in for the live stream, we do have a question queue that we will be taking questions during the show. Let's see. We have Signal, so if you have some super secret information that you want to share with us, you can hit us up on Twitter, and we will share our Signal numbers. Also... we have a Ko-fi account.
We do.
So if you would like to support the show, we are hoping to raise enough to get subscriptions going. You can give us a little tip. You can purchase stickers. Amanda even just created a new blueberry sticker.
I will be debuting that on my personal stream when the samples come in.
Very excited about that. And with that, we will be back next week.
We will. So remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. We will see you very soon.
Thanks, everyone.